Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode of A Taste of the Past is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, encouraging you to eat healthfully and nutritionally. Visit bobsredmill.com to learn more about their products. And use the code TASTE25 for 25% off your order.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past, and welcome to our new fall season here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And today we're going to be talking about colonial cooking and many things associated with that. Mary Randolph's book, The Virginia Housewife, is considered by culinary historians to be the nation's first truly regional American cookbook and the most influential of its time. And although Randolph was a knowledgeable cook, the majority of the labor in her kitchen, as in so many kitchens of that time, was done by black women. Not only black women, but enslaved black women. And while it's impossible to speculate on Randolph's relationship to these women, there is evidence that enslaved cooks had a significant influence on how she prepared food. Karen Hess wrote in the introduction to one of the early editions of the Virginia Housewife. Karen Hess, an esteemed culinary historian, she wrote that the black presence was infinitely more subtle in Virginia cookery than in that of New Orleans or the West Indies. Well, my guest today has cooked her way through the Virginia Housewife, and in fact, she was recently named the Virginia Top Chef, or noted chef by USA Today, and they named a chef for every state of the union. And my guest was named the chef for Virginia, and she is Lenny Sorensen. Dr. Sorensen is a writer, a chef, and Jefferson's Monticello resident culinary historian. She's a PhD and an expert in 18th and 19th century cooking methods used by Virginia housewives and slaves, including those who cooked for Thomas Jefferson. And she has been working in colleges and universities, at festivals, and for historic house museums, including the Monticello Kitchen. She's been teaching about food and family for more than 30 years. And her continuing interests incorporate kitchen and garden skills into the daily lives of the modern family. Next week, she'll be leading a Southern homemaking and homesteading workshop, but we'll hear more about that later in the show. And she'll be teaching and participating in the Monticello Heritage Harvest Festival at Monticello later this month, September 21st, I believe, where she will demonstrate open hearth cooking, as she has done so many times there, from frying pan to fire, Southern cooking on the open hearth with Dr. Lenny Sorensen. Lenny, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and good morning to you.
Good morning
good
to
day,
you, too.
Good midday.
Or good midday, right. Good lunchtime, almost, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to give away everything in the intro, but I thought it was really important to set it up. And you became very interested in the Southern cooking, even though you weren't always from the South. And a lot, and even though, oh, I would say that most of your background in this is academic, you also came to it just sort of by way of your background, your own background. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've been a farmer off and on for much of my adult life, I grew up in what was at that time a very backwater Southern California, nothing like it has become, in the 40s and the early 50s, surrounded by small farmers or families who still did a good deal of their own provisioning. And I was always intrigued by that, partly because the food was so good and simple and easily learned to use. I learned to cook from my stepfather, who was from New Orleans, who in the third grade had to leave the third grade in order to care for his younger brothers and sisters when his mother died. And he learned that very, very wonderful, rich, but simple New Orleans style, red beans, rice, greens, cornbread. And that's what he sustained his brothers and sisters on while his father worked. And so I grew up with that, what I think some people might call peasant food, and I always really loved it, and I was always intrigued by how it was produced, in order to who grew it, where'd they store it, you know, all of that kind of thing. So even though I went out and did a whole bunch of other stuff in my life, whenever I was cooking, it was in that, coming from that place about who grew the food, what did they think about it, how hard was it, you know, the mechanics of it.
The methods and the methods.
To me.
Right. Well, you were very prescient in that and way ahead of your time. And look at where we are today. Everyone wanting to get back to the land, everyone wanting to produce, you know, all the artisanal products and knowing who the farmer is and, you know, who raised what produce. But then
there's been waves of that.
Yeah.
You see, there were waves in the 50s. There were waves in the 30s. Being raised by a very radical left-wing, in a very radical left-wing circle, I had kind of was, somewhat even as a kid, aware of those waves, Adele Davis and Gaylord Houser, and of course, being in Southern California, the home of, you know, cult food of various kinds. By the 60s, the late 60s particularly, as this huge contingent of back to the landers, or however we are, counterculture people, as well, you know, depending on how you want to use, what language you want to use. I was kind of already in the older cohort of that because I was born in 1942. So in 1960, I was 20 years old. So that by the end of the 60s, I was a householder with children, had been a performer and all that stuff. But I was really cooking on a day-to-day, everyday feeding a family. And so those were always, that became, drawing on those traditions that I knew were very important to me, as opposed to, and I don't mean to demean them at all, but the kind of for people who were brand new to the concept, came out of activist meetings and restaurants and, dare I say it, a proto-celebrity chef of the day.
Right.
And those are not bad ways to get into it, but that wasn't kind of the way that I got into it. So by the time I then began to farm when I was 34, I had a lot of prep. And then I married a man who had been born on a farm in South Dakota, so, you know, had mad skills, you know.
Right. Well, then,
that's what he was doing.
And through that, and then later on, you established Indigo House, where the farm where you live, and gave cooking lessons, and had your famous historic dinners there, and then what I wanted to know is, what drew you then to the colonial cooking in Mary Randolph? I mean, you have gone so far as to adapt the book, and you've rewritten for modern cooks at least 12 of those recipes in a book, correct?
Yeah.
Through the seasons?
Yeah.
Through the seasons.
Well, the dinners and all that I'm doing now actually were preceded by my the fabulous experience that I had as a historian working in historic house museums all through the 90s and in the early 2000s, both at Colonial Williamsburg, cooking on open fires, and at Monticello, cooking on open fires out on Mulberry Road, and then in my more formal experience at Monticello as the African-American research historian, really getting a chance to be part of cooking in that very historic kitchen. And so my museum and museum house and kind of museum festival experiences were necessarily needed to be focused on the people who were doing these things.
Uh-huh.
Not that the elites who ate the meals and, in Mary Randolph's case, wrote the recipes. Those are fabulous things that we delight to have, and we delight to have the housekeeping books where we really have records of day-to-day usages of food and menus for many of these of the house mistresses of the antebellum. But they were the people in their kitchens, most often unnamed, certainly until very recently unsung, are the people that were really grasping my attention. How do we develop, say, historic house presentations such that the kitchen doesn't become this kind of dark, passive space in which we can say, you know, the food was served.
Right.
Without, you know, those were, it took a real shift, a real sea change in the way American historians have come over the last 25 years, really, to open out the interpretation and the acceptability of food as a valid, intellectual, economic, social way of looking at the past.
Yes.
And especially to look at people who, as I say, have often been unnamed. And we know they're there, but, you know, people who would say, well, I know there were 12 slaves on this place, but I don't know what they did.
All right. Well, in fact, 12 slaves. I mean, that didn't Mary Randolph's family employ, I think,
well, she was born 12? Into that elite. She was born into that very elite status. And at her childhood home, yes, they were enslaved. People doing all manner of labor, from field labor to house tasks. She then marries a very wealthy man. In fact, she's part of that huge strand of multi-threaded strand of Randolphs. She was a Randolph, and she married a Randolph. So she was Mary Randolph Randolph. David Randolph had a very prosperous plantation, and so she had 19 slaves there. Probably a significant number of them were field labor, but regardless, she had kitchen and house staff. And what we see in her, I think, is that unlike many a housewife who did the necessary supervisory task of making sure that all the food got ordered and was stored and was kept properly and wanted menus of a certain type and all, as was their duty and what they learned how to do as young women, that Mary really enjoyed doing it or felt had a real feel for it. And I imagine she, whoever it was that was her mentor, her mother or an aunt or however that worked, must have been pleased at this young woman who had such facility to manage a kitchen. Now, of course, I have no idea what her relationship was with her cooks.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. That's not in the record.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, even if their relationship was fairly cool and neutral, I believe as a cook, you would have been pleased to have somebody who obviously knew about food.
All right. So give you a little direction.
With.
Right.
You know what I mean? Well, so that, because certainly the cook, by the time the cook came along in the position as cook, after having moved up through scullion and assistant and all, the cook, mostly women, knew what they were doing. And so if you were working with a housemistress who also knew what she was doing, you could produce, you were much more able to produce routinely, very predictably, good, you know, fine meals. I mean, the crisis might happen with a cook who had experience, but who's now been sold into a home where the mistress is, well, I don't know, let's say 22 years old and has been pregnant now for 3 straight years and is going to go on to have another 11 pregnancies, and who doesn't know much about housekeeping. Do you see what I mean? That's
right.
A different
right.
kind of setup. So
right.
Mary has it's clear from her book, and that's why I love to have people read it. And submerge themselves, because it really tells a lot, yes, about her, but it gives us because she was so competent, it gives us a sense of the competence of the people in her kitchen.
Right.
We don't have their names, but we have their skills.
Well, and you got the sense that there was life in these kitchens, as you say, not just the hidden lives, and that there was a kitchen and food was served, but that there was so much going on. And in fact, later she went on to run a, did she run a boarding house, I think?
Due to a particular political crisis between her husband and Thomas Jefferson. Oh, and by the way, she was the older sister of Thomas Jefferson's son-in-law. So all of these people know each other well. I mean, they're all complexly aligned.
You mean an incestuous community?
Well, I know you're going to use that. It's that, you know, by our standard, yeah, we don't marry first cousins anymore. But in their day, the marriage of first cousins among the elites of white aristocracy here and in Europe was so common. It wasn't, you know what I mean? That was just a common thing.
Yeah.
Certainly they knew each other and had been entertained at the same homes, at other people's homes. They had a very strong sense of the world through which they lived.
Right.
You know, that was there. And so Mary is moving in these very elite circles always. And so after this political fallout, when they lose their amazingly beautiful house in Richmond, of which there are some photographs, which is really quite wonderful, she decided to open a boarding house, and she opened it about three blocks down from the General Assembly in Virginia, because who did she know? Well, she knew all the the big wigs who, you know, this is right at the beginning when the notion of hotels and the properness of women coming and staying in a hotel, a boarding house had a much more acceptable, a man in the General Assembly could bring his wife and daughters to Richmond and stay at Mary's boarding house and have it be a very acceptable, genteel atmosphere, you know, not rough or... and so she had, and she was very successful at it, and she earned a living. Now, that was, the timing was such that in about 1818 or 19, her health began to fail, her husband's health began to fail, and she moved to Washington to live with one of her children. It's at that point that she decides, it's the idea to take everything she knows about cookery and put it all in one book. And it's published by 1824.
Right. And it's amazing that, I mean, this, we're not talking about, you know, old manuscript cookbooks that have been, this was actually printed and published. And amazing.
Yeah,
how,
it joined Amelia Simmons of the late 18th century.
Right.
And she also... what it reflects to me, having read many other historical cookbooks, she really has one foot in the late 18th century, because she got married in 1790. So her housekeeping skills were learned in the 80s, and perfected in the 90s, and then became public and well remarked on in the. At the turn of the century, and for a few years, the opening years in Richmond, and then within her boarding house. So she's got several. We watch her in these recipes with this one foot in the 18th century, a foot in the 19th century, and also a foot in what we would think of as restaurant cooking, because that's really what a boarding house is.
That's right.
Even more so than the standard elite plantation dinner set situation or elite home in Washington or Richmond that had to produce a beautiful meal every day at the boarding house, that was kind of it ramped it up a bit, and so she's writing out of a real complex of foodstuffs, of food styles, of skills and availability of ingredients. that she doesn't write any menus, which is very frustrating. I would like to shake her sometimes.
Well, it's interesting, and you from a excerpt from your introduction to your project, your Indigo House project, you say that even then she and her enslaved cooks in her kitchens produced food that set the standard and excellence in Southern cooking, mm-hmm. which is I think very interesting. I mean, colonial America was in a sense very Southern. You think it's all Virginia, and I forgot to mention that you live in Virginia. I said you were a Virginia noted chef, but that you live in Virginia as well. And we forget sometimes, thinking of Washington, D.C., not being the South, but it is the South.
Oh, absolutely, because it was a home. It was the home of slavery, enslaved cooks, all of the ritual Virginia styles were done. And, of course, but being a capital city, it began to bring in, even though it was such an isolated, woebegone place for such a long time, for those who were there and who decided to build there and who decided to create a society there, they were people often who had access to the greater Atlantic world of industry, of goods. We drive by the Chesapeake or some of these areas today, and we see great stretches of water, and it's very beautiful and ecological and all that stuff. In her day, all of those would have been full of ship masts, full of ships, transporting goods back and forth and up and down all along the Atlantic and across the Atlantic and from the Caribbean. And so it wasn't unusual at all to buy imported macaroni.
Right. Well, that's a perfect place for us to break for a moment, take a quick break, because I want to come back and talk about the ingredients in some of the dishes in Mary Randolph's book. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back. I recently tried Bob's Red Mill's instant oatmeal, but it wasn't an easy choice which one to choose. They have so many flavors. I am kind of a stickler for the regular, unflavored oatmeal. That's the one I tried first, and I was surprised at how the oats retained their crunch and even their look. You could tell that you were eating oatmeal and not just a bowl of mush. But some of their other flavored oatmeals I decided to try, and I was really quite surprised. They have fruit and seed, cranberry orange, brown sugar maple, apple cinnamon, a lot of different varieties, and they all taste fresh and natural. And my colleague, Kat Johnson, told me that even though oatmeal is not usually a summer cereal, the pineapple and coconut gives you a taste of summertime. So I urge you to try these instant oatmeals. You'll be happy you did. These and so many other products can be found on their website at bobsredmill.com. And use the code TASTE25 for 25% off your order. That made you old, oh, shatter me, sweep me up into your hands, then scatter me. Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with Lenny Sorensen, and she is... so many things, Lenny. She, an interpreter of colonial cooking demonstrating open hearth cooking. And she has done an exhaustive study of Mary Randolph's The Virginia Housewife, considered one of the most important early American cookbooks that was printed. And tell us... I'm sure when you were doing all this, and as you go into these historic museum kitchens and do representations, what would the typical kitchens be like?
Dark, smoky.
Challenging.
crowded, yeah, hot. You know the old phrase, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen?
That actually comes
out of a real lived experience for people in these kitchens. Usually, little attention was paid to the comfort of the cook. That's just the way that was. They might whitewash the walls, make it a little brighter, but you have all this charcoal, you have all this coal. Depending on how well the fireplace draws, it is more or less smoky in the room. how much kitchen furniture might one have to work with. The technology of Mary Randolph's day was beginning to make a transition. The raised stew stove, a masonry stove with four or five or six sections that could have separate little charcoal fires that could then be, it was used waist high with pots on top of like trivets above the fire. Remember, until very recently, until the 20th century, everything had to be brought to the fire.
That's
or
right.
Moved away from the fire. That's how you did that. Whereas, so the stew stove was this. As early as the mid 16th century, you begin to see in certain very elite palaces the use of in Europe stew assemblings. You see it as part of the tradition of the Spanish. The very elite Spanish haciendas in Mexico, as part of their building style. So that was beginning to come in, and you begin to see it in French architectural books that happen to show designs in which the kitchen is shown. So, of course, Thomas Jefferson in his journeys, in his vast reading of architectural books, of which he had such immense interest, would have seen those. You know, would have understood what they were for, because he had been exposed to this to French cooking through various venues of eating dinners at people's homes, French generals, French diplomats, just French people who were visiting or staying in the United States. He recognized that, this is a new style of food. When I go to France, I really want to have someone trained to do this kind of cookery in that. And thus we see him taking James Hemings
right.
to Paris with him. Well, in that setting, James would have learned to cook both on the hearth as well as on the stew stove, because the stew stove is often used for fine sauces, for stuff that you really need to give attention to, and you know, stand and stir, things that are much harder to do on the big hearth itself.
Right.
So you've got this hearth that has usually, if it's big enough, it has at least two and probably several piles of burning fire, because you're going to use a different wood, or you want to have charcoal readily available. You're going to have some foods assembled on spits that are laid in front of the fire for roasting. And you're going to have, hopefully, a jack spit, which is this a mechanical wind-up with chains and ropes that turns the spit. That's assuming you don't have a little boy to do that, as would have been done earlier.
Because we're talking about cooking for a lot of people, too.
Almost always, yes, because at this level, the Jefferson household when there was no company was numbered anywhere from 12 to 14 people. So it's, cooking a lot of food. And it's not merely dinner. You've got breakfast, you've got dinner, and then you have tea or supper, they might call that. You have food for invalids who can't come down to the table, and they have to be fed certain kinds of food or considered proper. All of those go into deciding, and of course then whether you're rural or urban and what kind of resources you have, how fast you get with the technology. Well, pretty clearly it seems to me that when Jefferson returned to Monticello and updated the kitchen in the South Pavilion, which had a hearth in it and had been used as a cooking space, they added a stew stove.
We were talking when you said about how quickly you get the technology. We were also talking about ingredients. So we were before the break, and about the shipping, all the ships coming in and out and importing things and different ingredients. What do you think this accounts for a lot of the eclectic dishes that are presented in this book in 1824? There are. The variety of dishes is amazing.
Any of the American cookbooks. If it's a Boston cookbook and it calls for lemons, lemons don't grow in Boston.
Right.
So if it calls for white sugar, brown sugar, certain kinds of raisins, any of the spices, you know, nutmeg, mace, a lot of calls for that, brandy, all of the, you know, cinnamon, all of that all has to be factored in as imported items.
Right,
then
right.
You have people who, depending, especially if they're urban dwellers, they're going to buy, let's say regionally, particular products to store for the winter, but and that might become certain kinds of meat, stored meat. If you were on a plantation, you did as much of that yourself. You salted and stored your pork and your beef. But even Jefferson, who salted and prepared, his, you know, the staff did enormous amounts of butchering and salting and preparing for the large number of people that were there. He still was known for buying, you know, 39 Smithfield hams in a year. So he understood his local resources that were things that he really wanted to have as well. He then bought, as Mary Randolph did when she had moved to town, she must have purchased many of her things both through the general marketers, and that would have been the imported items and big barrels of flour and that kind of thing, but from the city markets for fresh chicken, fresh vegetables, fresh herbs, fresh milk. Those kind of items would have been available in the several city markets that had sprung up by the time she was working in Richmond.
And
so
she,
they were in a real range.
And she really seemed, she appears, if you read through the recipes or go from, you know, one section to the next, she really embraced a lot of the variety of produce and ingredients that perhaps a lot of cooks at that time would not have used.
Oh, I think I think she actually reflects what a lot of her cooks did use. I think it's much later in the 19th century that we begin to have much more. We begin to have ideas about what earlier people ate and how conservative. Because people in the late 19th century got pretty conservative, which came from a whole complex of reasons. Some of it had to do with the new. Seeming understanding of nutrition and how you cooked food and how it was used by the body. And, you know, there's kind of an array of reasons. And then the technologies. Mary Randolph was probably had one of the new technologies in her boarding house, which was the Ranger, the cast iron stove that had, you know, a place to boil water, and you could have an oven. That was called the Ranger. It was called a Ranger because you had two ranges upon which you could cook, two shelves, what that word comes from. And yet we find a description of that in Margaret Baird Smith in her letters, that in 1800 she knew a woman who had a Ranger, Mrs. Law, and she describes it very beautifully. And Jefferson appears to have had a Ranger in the president's house. So when Edith and Frances came back from the president's house, they were almost going down a notch in cooking technology because they'd been using a Ranger, and now they're going back to the use of the hearth oven. You know, that hot where you put the fire in the oven,
right?
And it has a flue that goes out through the big chimney, but you got to bring that oven up to very high. And then sweep it out, swab down the floor, and start baking in what is called a descending oven. As it slowly, you start
as
the hottest
cools
stuff,
down,
and
eat right.
the hottest stuff, and as it cools down.
Right.
So there's all of these. You got to know what kind of wood is best, what kind of wood is too fragrant or would leave overwhelm anything that was in the oven. What kind of wood burns fast? What kind of wood burns slow? What kind of wood do you need to make sure that come the morning there's still coals left for you to revive the fire? Because there would never have been a time in which you would let the entire fire go out. So because you want that fireplace wall to remain warm and ready to go so that you're not having to always warm it up all the time.
Yeah. A little different than saying I have to preheat the oven. I mean,
Well, we have reached that place, and I think a lot of those cooks would truly, really appreciate being able to just flip that thing
flip
up,
a switch.
You know, 400 degrees and cook, because it really took. That's why you had these long apprenticeships. And what's the role of the scullion? It wasn't merely to do all the dirty work. It was a proving ground that you could learn while doing the dirty work. Hmm. You see what I mean? And
yeah.
if you were then proved yourself by being biddable and mannerly in the kitchen and responsible and, you know, working well with others and taking orders well, then you might make the next stage up. Do you see what I mean? But
all
if
right.
you were, as some of us have kids, you know, who, you know, they walk in the kitchen and the cupboard doors open and all the dishes fly out, those are the people you don't want in your kitchen. You're
That's
not
right.
in the kind of high, elevated, elite, almost like very exclusive B&B kitchens, you
yeah.
know,
yeah.
that these elite home kitchens were. In those kitchens, everybody had to be on task, know what the task is, and able to produce, because when that bell rang at 2 or 3, whatever the dinner hour was, this meal that was almost always 3 or even 4 meats, 3, 4 kinds of other mixed or vegetable-y dishes, a soup, and generally 2 or 3 or 4 desserts every day. It'd be like cooking Thanksgiving dinner
every day,
you know,
right.
18 people,
right,
yeah,
right.
every day. And that takes concentration in that workspace of people that cannot, they can't be working in at loggerheads. They can't have anybody that's sloppy or giddy or not able to stir this for 5 minutes, you know?
Right. Well, and stirring for 5 minutes, that's very precise right there, which in a lot of the directions weren't so precise. As you cooked your way through Mary Randolph's cookbook, The Virginia Housewife, I mean, you know, you did this, and I'm sure that you ran into snags now and then, as we all do when we try to reinterpret these historic recipes, like what do they mean until it's flat or golden or until it's done, and how long is that? What were the challenges you found in trying, because you wrote this little book, this section on her book, not her section on her, in her book, but your own book, with your notes, and you interpreted 12 of the recipes for the modern cook called Through the Seasons, a garden of recipes from the Virginia Housewife. What were the challenges that you encountered when you tried to modernize these recipes?
Well, actually, the vegetable parts were the easiest parts. They were really as straightforward as their phrase. You just have to be, you can't do much to cauliflower. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
She tells you exactly when you pick peas. You pick them early in the morning while the dew is still on
mm-hmm.
them. Yeah, and you make salad a particular way. You make your, so the vegetable parts, I haven't finished this project, by the way. It's a long project. There's well over 400 recipes in her book, and I'm...
That to me is astounding to begin
working
with.
working my way through them.
Yeah.
Now, with the baking and breads, a baker's dozen, which is volume 2, that is just going to the editor's helping me with it right now, before it gets published. I'll let you know. That date, that's a little more esoteric because she's really talking to people who have cooks who have been baking bread all along. So she's a little more terse about her details. You know, she'll just say bake or bake fast. Well, you know, thank goodness for the internet and thank goodness for the wonderful historic cooks, especially European historic cooks, who have real handles on that 18th century usages of those terms
mm-hmm.
and how to know what a gill is, which is approximately 8 yeah, ounces.
Right.
So defining those, and then having had some experience myself, I'm pretty sure that a complete novice who has never cooked before at all would find much of her stuff daunting, of course, but they'd find joy of cooking daunting. Do you know what I mean? Even
right.
with all the specifics. So it really does it falls back on much about what I already know that comes out of my very long, you know, I've been cooking since I was 10, so I have to draw. Oh, yeah, I remember about that. Yeah, those two. You know, I mean, as I schmug along trying to figure it out. And so for me, the cookies are more making sure that I've kneaded them right and that I've let them rise and that I've done them in, that I've intuited steps that she just left out because it seemed so intuitively straightforward to her that she kind of left it out. And so I have to think about that. The meats, which are the next entry, which is going to come out in hopefully in December, volume 3, what's difficult about that is choosing meats that are available to me. Like, I would love to do her pickled herring. Well, I'm going to have to find live, ready-to-pickle herrings. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? Because she starts with her instructions how to go down to the where they're bringing in the herring and taking the live herring and throwing them into last winter's beef corning mixture that you've saved from your corned beef, from your salted beef.
You're going to be doing a lot of cooking on that one for a long time.
You know, to kill a turtle. She has specific instructions. Well, luckily I know a bunch of hunters and I've got some people who have volunteered and it's going to be a big project. And then I will try to do my best to document it, you know, all the way through so that I can end up with turtle soup.
Mm-hmm.
She's got, you know, with those subtopics, I have to come up with pig's feet. I have to find beef feet with the hair on them so that I can do all the steps that she requires in this, which is to scald and scrape, burn off the hairs off the feet. You know what I mean? I want to do it because I want to see, first of all, how long it takes. I want to see what it then tastes like. Now, for me, I then end up using fairly modern tools. I'm not doing it over an open fire or a hearth because I don't have that in my house. But I have a lot of older tools, and a lot of it is just the steps and not so much the fire source.
Right.
You know, that's important. But I love immersing myself one recipe at a time into... You know, I've just done this tavern biscuit, which is, they call it cookies biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
It is just one of the most delightful cookies I've had in years. And I'm going to make 10 dozen of them for my talk at Monticello in September as part of the thing. Mm. I won't be cooking on the open hearth.
Oh, you will? I thought you were doing a demo.
Oh, no, I'm going to be talking about it and really breaking out, looking at it from a more scholarly point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I have cooked on the Monticello hearth and in company with some really fine hearth chefs, which has been really great, Paula Marcoux and Michael Twitty and, other people who understand that kind of cookery.
Right.
But this time, say like the tavern biscuits, they are just as simple and just have this lovely, they're not even hardly sweet. They're just, and they just have this lovely aroma of spices. They're not overwhelming. It's just a great biscuit that could be served with so many kinds of other sweet dishes, you know, to augment them. It could be decorated. And so I had a lot of fun with that one because just discovering it, it's one that I will be adopting into my repertory.
Well, you're making me want to go home and open my book and cook it as soon as I get home.
I see. Well, yeah. I hope that you have the University of South Carolina Press.
I'm not sure which edition I have. It does not have Karin Hess's intro in it.
I don't have that one. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to be doctrinaire.
No.
It is, as far as I've seen, and I've seen a lot of the editions, it is the best.
Yeah.
First of all, because it also, Mary Randolph lived long enough to go in the next year and add some other recipes from her. So there's so she includes those additional recipes in the second edition, and of course Karin Hess was just such a wonderful food historian and spoke, you know, most eloquently about the times and Mary's family and about other about food sources in particular.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's very valuable. But it's just the way that it's as close to Mary's original concept. Once she began, and there were 19 other editions after she died, and they were all rearranged by thoughtful, in quotes, editors who wanted to make it easier to find their way, find your way through it. While that sometimes, you know, I want to use her order because of the way that it helps me see how she thought.
Right, right.
And what was important when I'm doing it.
Right. Well, that's that is on my list to get. But this came in a group of some of my other historic books that,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have so many books, so little time.
Oh, yes.
What can I say?
Yes, indeed. I know about that.
But,
I'm in the midst of book purging myself.
And so. In keeping with this whole tradition, Southern tradition of you're saying go, you know, take the pig's foot and you have to singe the hair and, you know, scrape it down. You are embarking on or have embarked on another project that you like to teach and you're giving a workshop on it. Before we run out of time, I wanted you to talk a little bit about that. And that's sort of back to nature kind of thing. And that's the homesteading and Southern provisioning, Southern homemaking project. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think a lot of people, I just keep it pretty simple at just home provisioning.
And home provisioning,
concept
okay.
That I... You know, I farmed for 8 years on 165 acres in South Dakota. And I had been cooking, of course, for a family long before then. And when on the farm, of course, I had the opportunity to grow and produce a great deal of what we ate. So I got a real taste of that. And I'm one of those people who's of an age that grew up on the Little House books. Not the series, mm-hmm. the books. You know, I had a certain element of fantasy, except that there I was in these communities of Norwegian immigrants, Danish immigrants, German immigrants, second generation Poles, you know, all farmers of the upper Midwest who came from these day-to-day cooking traditions and farming cooking traditions where, you know, you had to, you know, when all the guys are out there slinging bales, in the middle of this heat, they got to have dinner. They got noon. They have to have lunch a little later. You know, you're going to cook every day. Every day, you
right.
don't not cook. You don't get to just go out to we'll just go out to McDonald's. You're going to cook, and so that too has always been very interesting to me. How do you organize your food life so that you and your provisioning, meaning however it is you get the food in, hopefully. As much of it as you have the power to do, the skill to do, the time to do, the resources to do, out of your own energy, you know, raising animals or keeping chickens or having a garden, but also just how do you keep a family fed every day? And this is the same for men or women. Like I say, my stepdad fed all of his children, you know, all of his brothers and sisters while his father worked, you know. Is how do you do that every day? How do you plan ahead, think ahead, so that the food is good and in plenty and healthy and uses your time and your energy and your resources wisely?
So in
that's
this, so
what
in
home provisioning
right.
is.
So in this 3-day workshop, you're going to train modern housekeepers how to. Provision, Southern
yeah.
provisioning, right? Okay,
yeah.
So that's, as you said.
And I think what a lot of them who've come already have begun this journey.
Mm.
So I'm going to end up learning things myself. There's
canning.
Always, there's always that. But
right.
specifically talking about canning, we're going to can applesauce and tomatoes. We're going to can chicken and chicken stock. We're going to make some regular sandwich bread. We're going to make some English muffins. We're going to make some ricotta, you know, the simplest ricotta
mm-hmm.
cheese. And we're going to make some pasta noodles. Great. You know what I mean? With just the things that I've named there, you could put together combinations of foods that could feed people for quite a long time.
Right. Well, can you tell our listeners how they can find out more about this and more about you?
They can go to my website, which is indigohouse.us.
Indigohouse.us. Okay.
U-S. And I am so awful on URLs and HTTP things. I've almost got it up here. I'm just going to call it up so that I can give it to you. Without making a mistake, the URL is, it's called 3-Day Home Provisioning Intensive, Grayson, Georgia, High Hog Farm Events. And you could probably use all those keywords and find it.
But if they go to indigohouse.us,
there's a link there.
That's good.
If they do that, what is it called when you do the hashtag thing? There's a hashtag thing that says African-American chef and culinary historian. And, you know, there's probably different ways. I'm not a Luddite, but there's only so much technology that I'm actually able to
learn. Think if they go to indigohouse.us, they'll be able to find all that.
Okay, yeah. And Eventbrite is
if they go to your website and then they'll see the provisioning course, and then that will lead them to Eventbrite for
I see.
For
okay, that's how that works.
Yeah.
Fine.
Well, I went there. I found out.
Well, thank you very much for asking. You see, you always want to call on people to come and help, because they many times know far more than I do.
Well, Lenny, I'm sorry to have to end this conversation, because you are just a font of knowledge about all of this early cooking, and it is such a pleasure to listen to you describe things in such eloquent detail. But we'll do it again.
I hope that we will get a chance to do that. I thank you very much. And by the way, it's Monticello.
Monticello. You know, I said Monticello first, and I thought maybe I'm just doing it too Italian. Maybe it's Monticello.
No, no, no.
And we had that discussion on the phone, and then I forgot which one you said to say.
Just
it is.
Mostly to remind your audience.
Monticello.
Monticello.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Take care.
So much. And again, that's Lenny Sorensen, and her website is indigohouse.us. And I'm your host, Linda Palacio, and this has been another Taste of the Past. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.